Welcome to the Thompson Research Group Host DFS Flooring Conference Call. My name is Vanessa, and I'll be your operator for today's call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. During the question-and-answer session, if you have a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone phone. Please note that this conference is being recorded. I will now turn the call over to Kathryn Thompson. Kathryn, you may begin.
Thank you, Vanessa, and thank you for everyone joining today's call with DFS Flooring. Just a little bit of background on DFS. California-based DFS Flooring is the largest commercial flooring installer and services provider on the West Coast. They provide flooring solutions for corporate, education, food services, government, healthcare, and hospitality industries. The company's history starts back with Paul Singer Flooring Covering, which was founded in 1959, and that company was organically grown into what became Southern California's largest commercial flooring leader. In 1996, DuPont's fiber division purchased the company as part of the national commercial flooring consolidation, introducing DuPont Flooring Systems. Under the leadership of today's speaker, Richard Freeman, and his partner, Greg Keyes, the company's enjoyed considerable growth. He'll give a little bit more color on the company structure, but first, Richard, I'd like to join you for today's call. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Kathryn.
Yeah, just to get things started, I want to give a high-level question. Just tell us a little bit more about DFS Flooring. What are the end markets you focus? Maybe a little bit more color on your geographic reach within California, and particularly we'd love to get your perspective on your role in the flooring industry.
Thanks again, Kathryn, and good morning and good afternoon for those of you on the East Coast. My name is Richard Freedman. I am the CEO of DFS Flooring based here in Los Angeles. So from, I suppose, from my point of view, it's the morning, and for you guys in New York, it's the afternoon. I think, Kathryn, you're somewhere in between. I started my career with Leventhal and Haworth as a CPA, and in 1988 went to work for Paul Singer Floor Covering / MSA Industries as their CFO. MSA Industries embarked on an acquisition strategy to build out a national network of flooring contractors and dealers throughout the USA. I was instrumental in being part of the acquisition, running around the country, buying up companies. And within 4 years, we had 40 locations in 26 states. DuPont purchased MSA Industries and renamed the company DuPont Flooring Systems, also known as DFS Flooring. DuPont later sold their nylon business to Koch Industries as part of a divestiture strategy, which I believe at that stage was the largest private sale ever. It was a $4.4 billion sale of the DuPont nylon business to Koch Industries. Koch then decided to divest themselves of their downstream DFS business. Since I was instrumental in helping them actually get to the size they were, they also wanted me to participate and help execute the divestiture for them. During the time of the divestiture, I saw an opportunity for myself personally to buy back the Southern California business, which at that stage was a pretty modest business. Hence, you should put together two and two. DFS Flooring was, in a sense, the acronym for DuPont Flooring System. I was able to actually keep the name. Today, I'm proud to say that we are one of the five largest commercial flooring companies in the U.S. and the largest strictly commercial company in the Western United States, with offices of in California and Nevada. Our main focus is in corporate, healthcare, and education. However, what is now transpiring is that a lot of the first tier, and what I call the first grade, the real good general contractors, commercial general contractors, are getting involved in multifamily and assisted living. So our focus is also moving in that direction because, again, what used to happen, they used to be done more on the residential side, and over the last few years, business has definitely changed that these first-tier general contractors are doing this kind of work. We do a little bit of hospitality and refrain and do virtually no residential. One of the areas in that is actually booming is the modular housing business, which we're now starting to participate in. We deal with all the main manufacturers, the Shores, the Mohawks, the Armstrongs, the Interfaces, Bentley, Dixie, Milliken, Mannington, and we are one of their largest customers, commercial customers on the Western United States. That's a little bit of a history of who we are, what we've done, how we got to where we are today, and so on.
Perfect. And when you look at that end market focus, just digging a little bit deeper, just tell us how you go to market. Are you working directly with commercial contractors, or is it more with design firms? Just help everyone understand kind of how you operate and how you go to market.
So we go to market one of several ways. The first way is getting a set of plans and going through the general contractor as a subcontractor to the general contractor. Two, we work directly for end users. So a lot of the time when an end user just wants to carpet and paint or put in flooring and paint, they don't hire a general contractor. They'll go directly to the painter and us as we'll work as a prime contractor for the end user. We go to market also working for property managers. Big part of our business is the tenant improvement market, the quick turnaround, new leases being signed, and we work directly for them. We also have certain contracts in place with, for example, counties, with cities, and again with certain end users that are basically national end users. And lastly, but certainly not least, is we do work for the manufacturers. So a lot of the time when some of these major companies are looking to buy flooring directly from the manufacturers, we would work as a sub for the manufacturer.
Okay, perfect. Very helpful. Obviously, we've been living through quarantine and are dealing with kind of a post-COVID world. But just as a reminder, could you just give a point of view of how are demand trends tracking kind of pre-COVID? And what are your customers telling you now about current demand? And how much visibility do you really have about demand trends? So how far can you really reasonably predict?
So 2018 was a record year, and then 2019 was even better. The first quarter of 2020, we were tracking on a record year over 2018 and 2019. Then approximately towards the end of March, beginning of April, I would say for us, COVID really hit. And, you know, what we basically have found is that jobs that were in the pipeline continued and very few jobs were put on hold and canceled. You know, money that was set aside to do these jobs, the jobs are continuing. A lot of the time, the general contractors we were working for were under contract and they continued doing it. And the amount that was canceled and money was set aside was not a lot. But also the good news was that we were also deemed essential in California. I know New York, for example, our colleagues in New York had a harder time because they in the commercial market weren't deemed essential. But in California, we were deemed essential, subject to strict protocol and restrictions. The challenge really has been is that since April, our business is pretty much off about 20%. April, May, June, if you take it, the total product business is off about 20%. What has been encouraging is we have a segment of our business that is in flooring maintenance. And the logic was originally that we got into it, and the reason we're in it today, was a lot of the time the work that we did, particularly through a general contractor, was transactional. And through our maintenance business, and not to be confused with janitorial, janitorial is cleaning. Ours is really maintaining the flooring, giving extended warranties on the flooring. We were able to take these this transactional nature of the business and convert it into an annuity and a recurring revenue on an ongoing basis. What we've done trying to adapt to this new normal is we have taken our existing customer base and we have introduced a sanitizing service to the business, which is EPA certified to kill coronavirus. So we're not actually making any claims about it. It's all done by the EPA. We apply this product using electrostatic foggers. The difference between electrostatic fogger and a normal fogger is electrostatic fogger actually binds the spray, whether it's to the drapes, whether it's to the ceiling, whether it's to air vents, whether it's to countertops. And that has been a really good revenue source for us. The problem is it doesn't mitigate the loss in products, what we call product and installation sales. But from a revenue point of view, it adds revenue, but it's a very huge profit margin business. So, you know, that has helped us a lot, to weather the storm as far as keeping guys busy. Because what we've actually also been able to do is take some of our product and installation people. I'm happy to say we haven't laid off anyone. We haven't cut anyone's hours. And we haven't basically furloughed anyone. But we've been able to redirect them into these other areas. One of the other things that we're finding is what COVID has actually done, the changing in COVID, is that there's definitely been a change in product mix. As most of you on the call know, that probably the fastest growing segment of the business was luxury vinyl sales, LVT, and probably one of the fastest declining areas of the business is Broadnum carpet. But what we've seen with COVID is that there's been an accelerated sale of LVT because the perception is it's definitely more sterile, easier to clean, and then carpet. In addition, this we should bear in mind is the other than the real benefit of carpet, which is acoustics and price, with more and more disinfectant being used, and countertops and sanitizers being used, products falling onto carpet, especially if it's skein dye or piece dye, which means that it's not what's called a solution dye that is not dyed all the way through, can cause the dye to actually come off the fiber, as well as it can cause yellowing of carpet. So when everything is borne in mind, there is obviously a huge acceleration in the LVT and the resilient business as a result of COVID. So
That's helpful. One thing, a subject that you and I talked about really pre-COVID, is you were so busy and you had such a tight access to labor that you actually had to turn down business. You have some big national accounts out there like Starbucks that routinely do facility upgrades. For those type of customers, are they moving forward with their store redos, at least to your knowledge?
So the answer to your question is labor is a major problem. And, you know, clearly what is happening with the job market having loosened up a little bit, it's not as big a problem as probably when we spoke last, Catherine. Because at that stage, if you remember, we were actually turning down business not to do it. What we have found is on the retail front, anything relating to groceries, such as Targets, Walmarts, and obviously the Vons, the Albertsons, the Ralphs, for the people out west, are hectically busy. It's really, really busy, and there's a lot of work going on. And fortunately, what is happening at the moment is we don't have to turn that down because we've got excess labor. But I think as things turn around and the market basically becomes better again, labor is definitely a problem for now in the future. And, you know, it was one of the things that I've challenged the manufacturers and the mills for the longest time is that, you know, if they're intending to grow and they're intending to get bigger and, you know, part of the growth is going to mean more labor, where is this labor pool going to come from? Because we can do projections years out, but if there's not enough people coming into the business into installation, we're all heading for problems, whether we're on the manufacturing side or we're on our side of the business.
Yep, definitely makes sense. Tell us, you know, that kind of feeds a little bit into another question that I wanted to follow in, is what types of projects are moving forward and why? And then what types of projects aren't moving forward and why?
So from projects that are moving forward and projects that aren't moving forward, it's a mixed bag as we're talking about at the moment. The problem at the moment is with the uncertainty and the unknown. It's hard to know the desire, the appetite of the people to return to work, employed to work, return to work, as well as the consumer wanting to be in public places. Also, there is complete mixed messages about coming back to work. For example, you know, me being in California, which most people don't realize, is that they put in a rule that irrespective of where you got COVID from, if your employer tells you to come back to work before sometime in July, it's considered to be a workers' comp claim and not a health claim. So, you know, again, for those that don't understand what that means, is it, that affects your employee modification rate, which has the problem of two things. One, obviously, increase in insurance premiums. But two, what it does is it affects potentially your safety record of when you're trying to do these big projects and your employee modification rate is too high. So I'm going to answer this with those sort of provisos that it's difficult to predict, but what we're currently experiencing, healthcare is booming. The hospitals are, you know, they're redoing things, they're fixing things up, and anything to do with corporate, to do with healthcare, the United Health Groups, the Blue Crosses of this world, the Amgens of this world, they remain very, very, very strong and good. Education, what we found is that generally the private universities, the universities, there is money still available, particularly on the private one. And clearly all big projects that have been funded 6 months, a year ago, et cetera, are clearly still going forward and are happening. K through 12, similar, but again, anything that's really publicly owned or done is slow, and unless it's really either been set aside earlier or is basically an emergency to happen, is not happening. I'll tell you the one area that remains very, very strong, and it's an area that, Catherine, you and I really haven't spoken much about, is the modular housing market. And what is going on, particularly here in California and certainly in the biggest cities, Seattle, Portland, is that there's a housing shortage. And this modular housing and this pre-made modular housing is becoming a huge, huge business. And what we're being found is we are supplying them. In a lot of the cases before COVID hit, they didn't have enough labor to actually install the flooring in these modular housings. And so we've been working with some of these major companies, basically installing in the modular housing before they actually assembled and put together.
A quick question on that, the modular housing as a follow-up. There's the traditional manufactured housing, Clayton, Palm Harbor Homes, but then there are other kind of more modular where it's more traditional home builders that are skirting into more modular construction. Which flavor is driving demand, or is it really kind of both?
Okay, so I'm not talking about necessarily the modular housing that basically is built from the ground. The modular housing I'm talking about that is booming is the modular housing that is made in a factory. And the modules are actually shipped to the job site. And then pretty much the general contractor assembles them. They stack them up against one another, the boxes on one another, hooks up air conditioning, electricity, water, et cetera. And it's all pretty much they put together a housing project or a housing building literally within 6 months, as opposed to the residential builders that are actually building modular homes in an area, but each one is a modular home. These are all done in a factory, is what I'm talking about, is booming.
So it's more like a Kafka and that type of company. Okay.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
Perfect.
Exactly. They're doing that. They are really, really busy, and they're still doing well because, as I said, particularly on the West Coast here, there is a major housing shortage. And this is, as I said, I didn't really do residential work, but this is much more in line with commercial work. It's producing a lot of these, call it boxes, to be sent out and to be assembled.
Okay, perfect. Very helpful. Go ahead.
Sorry. No, go ahead.
And just a clarification from earlier, you said that business is off 20% since April. Is that on a year-over-year basis? And maybe talk a little bit about cadence in terms of what you've seen as we progressed into June.
Okay. Again, I'm going pretty much from the end of March to where we are today. We're off 20%. From last year through these 3 months. As I said, the first 3 months were up. The first quarter was up. The second quarter is down 20%.
Okay. Okay.
So it's not our year to date. We're not down 20%. It's the quarter down 20%. And as I'm seeing, it's difficult to answer what the third quarter is going to be like. The people in construction will understand this more than the people that are not in construction. But generally, the lead time from the time we get new work to the time we actually do the work is anywhere from 90 to 120 days. So the financial statements are not reflecting the true picture of what's going on. We will see what's happened here in the second quarter, more in the third quarter of financial statements. So what I'm saying, based on new jobs that we are booking, what we call booking, bringing in house, that is down 20% from April, May, June up to today.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
It does. And it would also imply that it's going to take a quarter for things to get better, really.
Right. One of the things that we are behind. As far as plans being able to be issued, the architects haven't been fully back at work yet, and so we actually are at the end of the cycle, the construction cycle. Flooring is one of the last things that go into a construction project, so we're the last to feel it, but we're the last to come back.
Yep, absolutely. Thinking about the global supply chain. We're seeing a lot of reshoring. In fact, there's LVT flooring manufacturer, Chinese manufacturer, that announced plans in North Georgia recently. Have you seen any disruptions in your supply chain? Who do you think is best positioned? And have any of these disruptions changed fundamentally how DFS thinks about partnering going forward?
So the short answer to your question is there's virtually been no impact on any sort of global supply chain disruption. And let me address why. Okay. The two main, or the three main areas that we deal in is, number one is soft surface, which is carpet. The majority of soft surface is made in the USA, as well as the fiber extrusion is made in the USA. Most of the manufacturers, the big manufacturers, the Shaw, the Mohawks, et cetera, are pretty much extruding their own fiber. So unless they close down for a period of time and they have to get up and running, they've got pretty good inventory levels. And as you know, with the move from Broadlam to carpet tile, much less fiber is required. So soft surfaces, other than where maybe Shaw closed down for a week and they added a week onto delivery times, we haven't seen a whole bunch of issues regarding that, the soft surface. As far as the biggest part of the business today, it's probably over 50% of the purchases, which is LVT. The good thing from our side of the fence, because you've got to remember we don't manufacture, is that LVT is interchangeable and is much more of a commodity. So if someone wants factory X's maple 20 millimeter LVT and they don't have it, there's a whole bunch of other manufacturers that do have it. And the difference between the maple that this company supplies and distributes versus what this company supplies and distributes is marginal. And as most of you are aware, over probably 75% of LVT that is sold is still the woodlook LVT. The only difference is whether it's a 12 mil, a 20 mil, a 30 mil, etc. But the products are pretty interchangeable from company to company. So if the manufacturers, in fact, had any sort of global chain problems or challenges, we didn't feel it. Because if they didn't have it, it was easy to interchange. The biggest issue, Catherine, that we're dealing with at the moment is the shortage of cross-country truckers. And it's probably the stuff that, again, people don't think about, but, you know, we've got to get material most of the time from Georgia to California and to Nevada. And the problem that we're having is twofold. One, there's a shortage of truckers. But second to the shortage of truckers is that where they were sending three or four or five trucks a day, what is happening is everyone is now consolidating. And until they've got a full load, and it may now take them two or three days to get a full load, they won't ship. So the bigger challenge we've had in this global supply chain and what has gone on is not so much as it's dealing with foreign countries, but what is going on here in the USA with truckers shipping across country. So it's a slightly different challenge. The last point from our point of view is that one of the areas that we haven't really spoken about that is a really fast-growing area, particularly on the coast and in the south, is polished concrete, and the look of polished concrete. And I always call it the urban outfitters look. And as polished concrete becomes bigger and bigger and bigger, and we're seeing it definitely taking market share from stone and tile and even from soft surface like carpet, there's no impact of any global supply chain challenges when it comes to polished concrete.
Yep.
So.
Interesting. Vanessa, I wanted to open the floor up for questions. And in the meantime, if you could just give the instructions for people to queue, and then I'll ask Richard one other question while people queue in.
Thank you. We will now begin the question and answer session. If you have a question, please press star then one on your touchtone phone. If you wish to be removed from the queue, please press the pound sign or the hash key. There will be a delay before the first question is announced. If you are using a speakerphone, you may need to pick up the headset first before pressing the numbers. Once again, if you have a question, please press star then one on your touchtone phone.
Richard, one other thing. So we've talked about the kind of the global supply chain, but when you think about the manufacturers, if you think about changes in market demand and what different manufacturers make and kind of how they've responded to this global pandemic, who do you think, and it can be public, private companies, who do you think is best positioned?
Do you want the actual names of the manufacturers?
If you're not comfortable giving, that's fine.
No, I'm happy to do that.
Yeah.
But I'm happy to do that, yeah, because it's a good question you're asking. So, look, if Catherine, and I don't want to get into, you know, debt structure and whether companies are worth what they're worth, but I'm talking just from a market presence, a name presence, and for what they stand for, I think Armstrong is in a very, very good position. Because as I said earlier, with the increase in healthcare, they still make probably the best known and the most brand recognized sheet vinyl. LVT, they were one of the first to market with their LVT, and as far as where the market is going, as I said earlier, it's heading a lot more towards resilient. So I think Armstrong is in a great position and well positioned going forward. Shaw, clearly they've got their hands at Shaw and Mohawk in every area, and they're obviously very, very well positioned going forward. Mannington is another one that is well positioned because, again, they've got all forms of carpet, and now they've got rubber with the purchase of Burke. So they're in a good position. You know, from my perspective, on the soft surface, because we're out here west, Bentley is the last carpet mill based out west, and they provide a huge value for us out here. You know, in the scheme of things and with what we're talking about, they're not big. But the beauty for what I do is they're a great niche player, one of, I believe, the last, if not the last, manufacturer based in California. So, you know, from my perspective, anyone that's really focused in the sheets, in the LVT, are the ones that are going to succeed going forward.
Perfect. All right. Vanessa, we're ready to take questions.
Okay. Our first question comes from Jeremy. Jeremy, your line's open.
Great. This is Jeremy Gold from Lone Pine Capital. Thanks for doing this. I was curious to try to get a sense for how much of the as you said, you know, in 2Q, we're kind of seeing 1Q trends right now. And basically, I'm curious, like, how much of the current work and the work over the next several months is you know, from the backlog or any sort of pent-up demand, and to try to get a sense for kind of what that looks like and what new demand looks like. Because I'm curious if, you know, are we still working through the backlog now? And new, you know, new activity is not coming back yet, such that there will be, you know, some sort of air pocket, or is there kind of enough new demand that we don't actually hit one of those air pockets as we work through a backlog? That's what I'm curious about. Let me know if that makes sense.
That's a really good question, because that's exactly what's going on, and that's what I was explaining earlier. So the financial statements are still looking good because we are eroding backlog. Because clearly, you know, if our second quarter we're off by 20%, that's going to affect backlog. We are eroding our backlog quicker than we're replenishing it. You've got to remember, in our business in particular, different, say, to the manufacturers, because you've got to remember, on a manufacturer's side, they pretty much, from the time we place an order to the time they ship it, it's normally within 30 days. So it's a lot more immediate. But we could take 60, 90 days to place an order, because the bigger the project, it doesn't start for a while. So in our business, the erosion of backlog is huge. From what you're asking on the manufacturer's side, mostly, where they going to see it, in my opinion, is going into the third quarter. Because if we're dropping down now, they're not going to have the orders that we're going to be placing going forward. So they, in my feeling, is their numbers are still being good because of what you've asked, because of the erosion of backlog. But with our backlog falling going forward, going into the third quarter, the order entry for them is going to be less because we've got less work.
Got it. So that makes sense. I mean, so for your own business, so are you expecting 3Q? If I'm understanding everything you're saying correctly, are you expecting in the third quarter to be down more than the current 20% and then to recover from that?
If I was going to guess, because as I said earlier, it's hard to predict. There's so many uncertainties and unknowns.
Yeah.
It's hard to predict. But if you said to me, you know what, Richard, how are you predicting the third quarter? I think the third quarter potentially is going to be worse than the second the second quarter. I think if we were down 20-30%, I wouldn't be surprised. And the reason I'm saying this again, what has happened is that people haven't been working. So the architects have become slow. Let's start on the corporate. The brokers haven't been going out to show people's faces. Nothing has been leased. So from that, the designers are not preparing any new plans. And even if the designers wanted to prepare plans, a lot of these planning offices until recently have been closed and haven't opened up again. Okay? Then what has happened is once they open up, okay, and the plans go in there, then they have to make sure all the financing is in place. Then they hire a general contractor to budget it, and then the process starts. So when you're looking at the people that are manufacturers, they're in a similar position than I am in, is that we're the last to feel it.
I'm going to listen to it.
But we're going to be the last to things pick up. So to answer your question, I don't see in our business and in the manufacturer part, the second and third quarters being very strong.
That's helpful. Thank you.
Our next question comes from Brian. Brian, your line is open.
Hey, I was just wondering if you could touch on if you had seen any odd behavior from the manufacturers during this time, if anyone's been trying to cut price to get volume or market share or just any kind of bad actors out there.
Brian, that's a great question. There are a couple of things that are obviously going on that you guys are fully aware of it. Obviously, oil prices at this stage are down. Obviously, interest rates are down. And obviously, demand is low. You know, one of the things that manufacturers need, and the only way manufacturers really make money is on throughput. They need the throughput in order to make money. So what I'm currently experiencing is at the beginning of this year, if you had asked me after the first quarter of this year, I would have expected, with demand being as strong as it was, I would have anticipated price increases, quite honestly, because demand was strong, things were going well, and I expected price increases. What is now happening is that you're certainly not seeing any price increases because of what I've just said. But more importantly, you know, the biggest challenge that manufacturers have is because, as what I said earlier, is that LVT is such a commodity. You know, your price variances cannot be a lot because the products are pretty homogeneous. So the answer, that was a long way of saying to manufacturers are not pushing up prices. If anything, you know, they slightly lowered it to be aggressive, but nothing dramatic either way at this stage.
Okay, we have no further questions at this time.
Thanks. And just kind of following up on another question is, when you, with a change, you're seeing a change in surface types in a post-COVID world. Are you seeing any type of change in folks trying to go down in price point or trying to basically value engineer projects?
Jennifer Friedman trying to call. Friedman?
The answer to that question is everyone at this stage is trying to value engineer. Money is tight for a lot of people.
About 10 minutes ago, yeah.
And everyone is trying to value engineer. So that is happening. Whether people, you know, are doing taking lower margins because of what's going on, I'm not really seeing it at this stage, but I'm sure that's going to happen, particularly if I'm right, that the second and third quarter, and particularly the third quarter, becomes rough and tough. You will see price pressure on margins in our side of the business.
Yep. That's helpful. I think we have one other question in the queue.
One more question from John. John, your line is open.
Hey, thanks for taking the time. I was wondering if you could kind of expand on LVT. I think, you know, we're pretty familiar with LVT as far as the residential application goes, but maybe, you know, it seems like it was introduced on the commercial side as like a complement to carpet, where we would, you know, see like little kitchen areas or closets or something like that. Have you seen this grow on the commercial side? So, like, the commercial spaces are starting to just do complete LVT floor instead of, or is it taking away from carpet at all? Or is it still just kind of in those ancillary kind of locations in the office?
Okay, so let's just go through a couple of segments, okay? Basically, if we talk about education, both K through 12 and higher education, it's definitely chopped badly into soft surface. I mean, LVT has taken over classrooms, you know, that had carpet in it. The only thing, maybe exception, is kindergartens, where they, you know, they still want a little bit of soft. But where people are pretty much spending most time standing on the floor, that's happening the whole time. You're even seeing it in hospitality, taking away from carpet. I mean, a lot of the hotel rooms, the new boutiques and modern, are putting LVT in instead of carpet. The office space, what we're finding is where it's taking away in the office space, as you said, is the cafeteria, the break room areas, and also in the lobbies. Instead of spending the money, you're talking about value engineering, is putting stone in the lobby or tile in the lobby. It's going, they're putting LVT into the lobby. But carpet in the corporate office state is still the largest segment of office space. It hasn't taken off an office space as part of the as compared to the other part of the commercial business.
Okay, and then what about as a follow-up, like what about like distribution centers and warehouses and things like that? Are they going away from you know, like concrete floors, or is that still kind of the main surface?
No, that's, I mean, what I call the Costco look is very prevalent, other than a little bit of office space in industrial. You know, they've got a little bit of an office that's, you know, carpet or LVT, but the preponderance of the floor is still, you know, concrete. I call it, as I said, the Costco look.
Sure. So, and then lastly, so then is there any kind of trends that you think have been more prevalent over the last year or two that seem like they're sticking that we haven't discussed that people should kind of be paying attention to when we think about the market? Or is it, you know, it's kind of been the same the last few years?
You know,
outside of what you said.
The trends definitely is towards sanitation and cleanliness. And, you know, the real question that one needs to ask oneself, you know, even in the corporate office space, is are people going to move again away from the benefits of acoustics and price in the office space and move towards more, you know, sanitation and more, not just sanitation, towards something that can deal, you know, with cleanliness, something that looks cleaner, something that looks better for employees to come to work. You know, you guys that are in New York probably are even a better position to answer it than I am, because there's so many more people and you've got so many more high rises that I would think, you know, that would be a bigger concern.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Excellent. Richard, just kind of for parting thoughts, would love to get, what is your vision of a post-COVID world over the next, say, 12 to 18 months? Do you look into your crystal ball?
What, you know, I see from our side of the business, and it's really happening already, is that the general contractors, the end users, are becoming a lot more concerned about the viability of the subcontractors and the people that they're dealing with. You know, financial wherewithal, being able to bond, to be able to cover the projects, to be able to finance these projects, because you've got to remember, in our part of the business, what we're doing is we're paying labor every week, we're paying for materials generally within 20 to 30 days, and we're waiting anywhere from 90 to 120 days to get paid. So financing becomes a big part of our business. My feeling is that the banks, they've already started tightening, are going to continue tightening. So I think we're going to see, unfortunately, a lot of people actually closing their doors and going out of business. And it will once again play into the hands of those that have the financial strength and the financial wherewithal in order to weather the storm and to finance these projects. You know, in 2008 and 2009, that's exactly what happened. In fact, we grew more in 2008 and 2009 because of the lack of competition, particularly when it came to major projects. And although I'm not hoping people go out of business, reality says in the next 12 to 18 months, that's what's going to happen here in our part of the business.
So really, just kind of to summarize, and this is a trend that I think we're seeing from other companies, those companies that have already the financial strength, but also importantly, the ability to carry inventory, whether you're a distributor or otherwise, will further distinguish you from your peers. Is that
correct.
A reasonable assessment?
Okay. It's an accurate assessment. That is correct.
So whether it's you or you're, say, a Ferguson as a plumbing distributor or a Beacon, you're going to be better positioned.
Right. Yeah. Leverage in this environment, I think, is a killer. Unless the feeling of the people on the call is that the banks are going to loosen up. But I don't see it. I personally don't see it. But I've also been wrong. Yeah.
Yep. All right, Richard. Well, listen, thank you so much for your time today. We really appreciate it. I look forward to us catching up again. The last time you and I, we've spoken several times since COVID started, but before all this chaos started, you were going to New Zealand to vacation. I hope that over the next 12 to 18 months, you can actually make it to New Zealand for a little R&R. Thank you.
Thank you. Me too. Thank you all.
Thanks, Vanessa.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. This concludes today's conference. Thank you for participating. You may now disconnect.